welcome to the KunstlerCast. Thanks for listening in. And thanks to all the generous listeners who have supported this podcast over the past year. If you haven't already but would like to support this podcast, you can become a patron of this show by making a small monthly contribution through my Patreon page. To do that, you can either search for me on patreon.com or use the link in the upper right-hand corner of my website. It's a pleasure to welcome back Jason Horsley, who presides over the blog Autoculture and the Liminalist Podcast. Jason is a UK expat who now lives in rural British Columbia, Canada. He describes himself as, quote, a high-functioning Aspergian, unquote, and his work often takes readers and listeners to the further outposts of culture where neuroscience and the occult shake hands with politics and showbiz. Jason is a hard-working professional intellectual who brings an original worldview to the events of the day. We recorded two podcasts in this session, the one in which I interview him for my podcast, and the one in which he interviews me for his podcast, The Liminalist. And I'll put the link up for that in the show notes on the KunstlerCast page of my website. Here we are. I'm talking to Jason Horsley out in British Columbia. How are things out there?
They're extremely cold, actually, Jim. It's like minus 20 yesterday with wind chill.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
it's 50
I know.
Degrees here. It's like a spring day. That's an inversion. Well, Jason, you're the author of the Autoculture blog and the Liminalist podcast.
Yep.
Let's start by reminding listeners who may not have heard the podcast we did maybe a year or so ago. What is the liminal and what is a liminalist?
Liminal is an anthropological word and it comes from limen, which is a threshold. So it relates to a space between states. I mean, choose your example. A hotel is a liminal place because you're in between one place and another when you're staying at a hotel. Adolescence is a liminal state. Hypnagogic, hypnopompic states, they would be liminal when you're between waking and sleeping. There's countless examples of liminality. In the anthropological sense, it generally refers to, I think, anyway, at least the example I'm most familiar with, is to do with rituals and how they are designed to allow for rites of passage from one state to another. So coming of age, rite of passage is the most obvious one, that the community will create a period of liminality in which the rules of that community are suspended in order for the upcoming generation, the younger people, to have this rite of passage in which they are able to discover for themselves their own sense of what's true and false and right and wrong. And there's a ceremony master who guides them from childhood to adulthood through this liminal space without imposing anything on them or directing them, just there as a kind of beacon to which to move towards on the other side of this threshold.
I have to imagine that we have a rather defective process for that in our culture. I don't see people being guided into adulthood very well or in any really kind of coherent way now. That seems to have all kind of broken apart and fallen apart.
It absolutely does, yeah. So that's a good concrete example of that degeneration would be exactly that, like how people enter into adulthood left to their own devices, which is really following the examples given by culture. So in my case, it's a very common one. It was smoking cigarettes at 14, obviously masturbating to porn and what have you, drinking alcohol, going to parties and so on. I mean, it's got much more extreme now in terms of what children do to feel like adults. Another thing, I mean, about the liminal period is it is about taboos and testing the limits of what you can, not what you can get away with, but what you can do within a culture without, or a community without being rejected by that community. It relates to the whole thing of boundaries, like how do we discover our boundaries for ourselves rather than having them imposed upon us. Because if they're imposed upon us, we will always feel restricted by those boundaries and we'll rebel against them. So hence you have the modern or postmodern rite of passage is simply a rebellion against the hypocrisy of our society, really, you could sum it up that way, as opposed to really discovering what is in us that we want to express. And expressing it in a space that we feel safe, that we won't be judged for it. And it, we might get it wrong, but we won't be judged or condemned if we get it wrong. That's very essential for all of us to discover ourselves in relation to the community that we exist in. And that's pretty much lost. And to answer what is a liminalist, well, it's the idea of applying liminality. So with a conversation, my aim has been to suspend to as much as possible the usual structures or conventions of interview or even conversation in the normal sense, like how are you, I'm fine, all of those things that we fall back on, and to make it as liminal as possible in terms of two people meeting to have a conversation without having too much of a preconception of what they're going to talk about or why they're talking. It's just we're conversing to explore and find out what the limits of our experience are. So it's more experimental, more free associative. That's my idea of liminalism, which is cooperating with the experience of being liminal rather than trying to pretend that we're not. We either pretend that the old structures and values or the false ones we were given are real and that they hold up, which is doesn't work, or we pretend that we've managed to invent our own and created an identity that's real and solid and true, and then we just act that. But it never is, because we haven't allowed that period of uncertainty and of unknowing in which a true expression can emerge from within us.
Well, there are a number of things that you're prompting me to think by saying that. One is that you mentioned people trying to operate within whatever community they're in. And there are an awful lot of people there who, in the United States, who are not in any community whatsoever.
No, but they're in a, what would you call that? Because it's absolutely, the whole community thing is pretty much gone now, but yeah. they're still in a collective ideological reality set, whatever we want to call it, the culture. They're in the culture.
They're in that kind of confabulated matrix of, I don't know, celebrity news and apparent events. But it seems to me that what's taking the place of that, of course, is the simulacrum of social media, which gives people the appearance of being part of some kind of a community, but really isn't.
Well, it is and it isn't. It's interesting because I was going to ask you this question, I hope to, before we wound up, but I didn't get to it, which is about Marshall McLuhan and his prophecy of the global village. Now, I was going to ask you about it in reference to, you know, the techno-narcissistic culture and how it's coming to an end, and to what extent have we achieved McLuhan's vision, and to what extent does it inevitably fail because of the technology and the infrastructures that we needed to create it if they collapse. But this is what we've created, something similar to what McLuhan predicted, which we can all have this experience of being connected to each other on the whole planet through the technology. But there's something illusory about it, and it's interesting question to put our finger on what it is that's illusory.
Well, one thing that seems to be illusory about it is that it's mostly about economic transactions more than anything else. Those economic transactions have been enabled by certain conditions that we enjoyed in a certain period of history, and now those conditions are going away. The world is probably going to become a wider place, a wider world, a bit less connected. I don't think that there will be no global trade, but I think that there's going to be less of it. So I don't know what happens to this global village once it becomes less of an integrated economy. It has become pretty integrated, pretty remarkably integrated. The fact that you can move immense amounts of goods from Sri Lanka to the Kmart in Philadelphia is quite a feat, but it can only really be accomplished under the special conditions of, you know, having a lot of cheap petroleum and
I'm not sure that that's going to be happening in the years ahead.
So you use Facebook, and Facebook isn't ostensibly a place of commerce, and yet it kind of is in a way, because it's as though Facebook only came about as a side effect of this commercial infrastructure.
Well, for me, Facebook is just a billboard for posting stuff that I work on. I don't check in on my friends' photos of their dogs or kids or anything like that. So I don't have much experience with how that.
But you have conversations, don't you? Like exchanges with people.
Not really. I mean, people, I don't even completely understand how Facebook is structured. And I know that people have conversations on my Facebook page about things that I post, but I rarely participate in them.
Oh, okay. So you do just use it like a billboard, essentially.
Yeah, it's just really kind of an advertising platform for me.
So it is totally that, right?
Well, in any case, I think we've established an idea of what the liminal is. But one of the things that I've noticed is that what I would consider liminal is now moving from the margins of culture and economy more to the center, especially with Trumpism. How do you feel about that?
So that's an example of something that you'd say was marginal that's now coming mainstream, which is relevant to me because it's, a lot of my research is in the parapolitical, what I call social engineering and stuff, and that often got tarred with the label of conspiracy theory and stuff. I mean, that was moving into the mainstream for some time, but with Trump, it really has landed right in the center because Alex Jones is buddies with Donald Trump, and then we have this whole thing of the so-called alt-right. You know, it's really interesting and perplexing, the whole thing, because, like, this experience, and I guess this is getting to the question of how real is this community, you know, this virtual community, that we have this sense of actually knowing what's going on, or what's real, or what's unreal, or what's marginal, or what's mainstream, based on really very little. Like, it seems like a lot because we've got the internet and we can just click and just keep clicking until we fall asleep at our desk kind of thing. There's no end to the different sites we can go to. So we have this sense that we're really connecting to thousands and thousands of different viewpoints, but we don't actually know how controlled the internet is or the media sphere is in terms of how much it represents reality. So, for example, the idea of the alt-right, it's quite hard to verify if there is such a thing as the alt-right. You know, and if there actually is, how much of it was created by what we would think of as the left? So David Brock, for example, was very busy paying people to go on the internet and pretend to be anti-Semites or misogynists or homophobes and so on in order to create or strengthen the idea that Trump was all of those things and that Trump supporters were these kinds of people. And then you even have bots that are actually, you know, computer programs that now have passed the Turing test that people, you know, we don't know for sure when we're interacting with a bot or not. If it's a brief, limited interaction, I think they can do that. So, you know, how real is the alt-right, really?
Well, explain to the listeners a little bit about David Brock and who he is and what his weird journey was.
So Brock used to be a sort of spin doctor for the right. He was very busy with his perception management from that angle, but then he got recruited by the Clintons and he became a spin doctor for the left. And he's created the Correct the Record is one of his projects. And Media Matters is a very well-known outlet now. They've just been very busy, I guess, what I was just describing before, like creating the perception of different people, different attitudes, in order to reinforce the perceptions that they want to create in order to push the programs or the parties or the individuals that they want to promote. I'm going to oversimplify it because then I'm on safer ground, but the old thing of how a king that's smart will always create his own opposition. He'll always create a movement you know, he'll send his little agents out there into the community to create a rebellion or a resistance against him and his power, because that way any real dissidents will join that movement and the king will have complete, you know, knowledge of what's going on and basically have control over it. So this thing of creating one's own opposition is strategic in a very obvious way in terms of what I just said, but it's also a way to strengthen the positions that you're trying to push. So, like, the more that Brock and his team could create the idea of this dark, destructive, deplorable alt-right movement associated with Trump, the more obviously people who find that kind of thing naturally abhorrent are going to huddle together to support Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So that strength is kind of, and it's a macro version of the negative identity, which is how we as individuals tend to look for, find, and use people and ideas to disagree with in order to reinforce our sense of identity and who we are. So we define ourselves by what we're not. That's like a basic psychological principle that we're all, you know, like the child who doesn't want to be like his father, doesn't want to grow up to be like his father or his mother. And in order to avoid that, they do everything they can that is different from the way they perceive their parent to be. Well, they end up really becoming like their parents because they're still defining themselves by that person, by that individual. So that's like a fundamental characteristic of our culture, I think, relating to this lost rite of passage of actually discovering your own boundaries, discovering your own internal sense of who you are. It's constantly referring to the outside, whether it's authority figures or whether it's the culture in general, and either defining oneself by that, aligning with it, or defining oneself against it. As I said, I'm not very good on Brock or any of these things in terms of specifics because I use these things as lenses through which to look at the larger social psychological phenomenon that's going on. I'd say is just a specific example of using that social and psychological principle, understanding it and using it, applying it in order to bring about specific results. And I think it was compelling to me to look at that because I got a little bit pulled into the election frenzy, even though I don't consider elections to be important in terms of, I think it's largely theatre, the election is my feeling, and that it's actually more or less worked out in advance and then they put on this big theatre to make it seem as though the people are actually deciding. I found it more compelling this time around because of what you've talked about. There was just so much polarization, just never been so polarized. And then if you look at Brock, you can see how that polarization was deliberately intensified as a way to manipulate people, mm-hmm. their perceptions and their decisions.
Well, culture seems to be a kind of a shape-shifting monster, and to do so in a strange recurrent sort of way. It's very interesting right now, for example, that we're seeing what might be called reverse McCarthyism on right. the part of the Democratic progressive side of the spectrum. You know, now we're seeing this tremendous paranoia about Russia and Russia's intentions. And, you know, this is exactly what the extreme right was doing in 1952.
Yeah.
And they're doing it without any irony whatsoever. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, without awareness of that they've become the very thing that they once deplored or still deplore.
It prompts me to think a couple of things and wonder how you feel about it. One is that this shape-shifting monster of culture is a very impermanent state of affairs, and especially the manners and you know, the behaviors of human beings and the beliefs that they develop that go with a particular phase of culture. It's astonishing how different these ideas and behaviors and mannerisms are. Just the other night, I was, out of sheer curiosity, I was looking at an old Francis Ford Coppola movie from the early 80s, called One from the Heart. It's It's one of his least known movies, a very obscure movie. It was a musical like La La Land, which is a big hit now. But One from the Heart, which had music by Tom Waits, was a tremendous flop and came close to destroying Francis Ford Coppola's career. It did destroy the Zoetrope studio that he was trying to build. What I noticed was how different people's behavior and mannerisms were, especially in matters of romance in 1980 than now. And, you know, of course, it turns out, 1980 is a long, long time ago. I mean, it's as far away from today as when I was in college, you know, the flappers were. Of the 1920s were for me. What I wonder is, what do you think about the impermanence of culture and the way it does shift and our awareness of the recurrences that go along with it?
That's a big contributor to the destabilization of individuals, is that very thing of how impermanent culture is and how threatening that is, because the more we allow ourselves to be defined by culture, basically we exist in a culturally created identity, which is something it's funny you brought up movies, because that to me has been for years I thought I didn't have an ideology, because I was raised as an atheist. My father and his father and that side of the family were social democrats or whatever they would call themselves. They're socialists really, but they were rich, and I saw through the hypocrisy of that very young. So I didn't adopt any of the political beliefs. I did adopt atheism, but then I discovered to my own satisfaction that that wasn't sufficient to explain the universe. So it was as though that ideological cultural conditioning didn't stick. And so for years I believed that I'd somehow dodged the bullet of ideological indoctrination. But over time I realized that it got, you know, the devil that you don't let in through the front door comes in the back door, that it got me through artistic culture. Like my family was also, they worshipped intellectuals and artists and the arts in general. And so I'd adopted that, and movies just became my religion. Mm-hmm. So from quite a young age, but a formative age, like adolescence, where a person is seeking an identity. And so I became a fan of Clint Eastwood, and I got into these very violent movies, and kind of the opposite of my temperament. Like, there was a period where I actually wanted to be a policeman in San Francisco, because Dirty Harry was my favorite movie. And you know me well enough, I think, to know that that was about as far from who I actually was and am as I could possibly have, you know, tried to aspire. So really entering into this delusional identity state that provided some sort of refuge from, you know, the difficult reality that I was entering into as an adult, using the culture to do so, to forge that identity out of, and not realizing for decades, you know, how false that was, how arbitrary it was. I mean, this is a relatively new thing. I mean, at least if we think of the history of humanity, we don't even know how far back it goes, but we certainly know, and you were pointing out, that cultures didn't used to change so rapidly, and they weren't so complex and so varied. So I think it's fair to say that we've become more and more encultured, or culturally embedded, if you like, over the generations. And so the result of that is that we have less and less a sense of who we are outside of the culture. And this isn't even the community, like, to bring it back to this original point, like, culture and community aren't exactly the same thing. Like, before you have a culture, you have a community, I think. And then the community, they have certain ways and behaviors, and then maybe they develop beliefs and so on and so forth. But initially, you can see, like, the animals don't really have culture. They have community, and then they have nature, and some of them don't even have community. The point I'm getting to is that I'm sure that you've thought of this, I think many people have, that the way that we think about our present beliefs and perceptions, which really create our identity as much as our memories do, we think about them as empirically, ontologically real. So we have these ideological values, this set. The very nature of it is that we can't question it because we think that we've got here through a valid process of sorting the seeds, if you will. So, you know, now we know that slavery is wrong. Back then, they didn't know because they were ignorant. And essentially, we kind of look back then, they're bad people. Though if it's Abraham Lincoln or someone, we'll cut them some slack and say, well, they were just ignorant. But still, it's kind of, let's not talk about that aspect because now we're enlightened. Well, you know, that's double think, because if we can look back at our ancestors and respect them as human beings and see that they got some things wrong, then we have to be able to apply that to ourselves in the present, but we don't. And when we're less and less able to do so, the more and more encultured we become, because the more our identity is actually invested in the beliefs and the ideologies that we've created. And I think that is fundamentally unstable, and yet it's not paradoxical, it's a vicious circle. The more unstable we feel, the more we cling to the culture and the identity that we have. So it's, I think there is an inevitable snowballing or avalanching or whatever you would call that process, where a culture becomes less and less stable and therefore more and more oppressive.
I notice in your blog that you've been a little bit preoccupied with the notion of human malevolence. What I wonder about it is, you know, we have easy reference to the problem of evil in historic times. You know, we have a pretty firm idea of what we think the Nazis were about, and the Belgian Congo under King Leopold, and other, you know, real instances of fairly easily identifiable evil. But what about the evil in our time? What do you make of our awareness and consciousness of the evil in our time, and how evil is it?
Well, evil is not a word that I use without quotes, and even malevolence I put in quotes because that came from Gary Hyatt, who I was talking to, like he was using it a lot, although I think malevolence is a better word than evil. Mm-hmm. I think evil has these metaphysical associations and baggage.
But yeah, malevolence is more a question of motive almost.
Yeah, I guess, and I do think there is malevolence in terms of terribly motivated people doing terrible things, but I think that there's a lot more people doing terrible things with good motivations or good intentions anyway. So then we're talking about misguidedness, distortion or delusion. And I would say that delusion has never been so entrenched or so deep or so profound as it is now. I would say that I can't compare it. I don't remember past lives in a previous culture. So this really is based on this single life experience. I'm 50 now, coming up to 50. And it's a little hard, obviously, to say. It's so subjective. And, you know, how much have I just become more aware of how delusional the world that I live in is, and how much has it become more delusional? It'd be difficult to say. So, like I say, distorted or what we might think of as malevolent behaviors, they do have a cause. I don't think that they just come out of nowhere. You know, I prefer to look at the causes than the activities themselves. But on the other hand, if you want to get to the causes, you have to find some effects. I think you've got to start with the effects. So my focus for the last 3 or 4 years, I think, has been on organized child abuse, sexual abuse of children, and how that connects to or is revealed as high-level, organized, what are known as rings, you know, pedophile rings and so on. I don't particularly like the language because I think that it misrepresents just how pervasive this phenomenon is. Hmm. I think it actually is throughout our culture. And there's a historian called Lloyd DeMaus who's mapped it throughout history, that not necessarily organized, but sexual child abuse has been prevalent throughout history, and it still is. Now, what's changed is kind of the cultural norms or the cultural rationalizations by which we conceal these realities.
Well, let me stop you for a minute. I'm getting back to something we touched on earlier, is this, maybe you could call it a cult of child abuse. Is this somehow some kind of a rite of passage ceremony thing that has just gotten out of hand in a culture that has no meaningful rites of passage, where adults lead the young into adulthood?
That's an interesting leap. I think there is some relationship, but I think it would be quite difficult to work it out. First of all, because I think that the kind of organized, directed, intentional child abuse usually involves very young children, even infants.
Ah, you're kidding.
No.
I don't know anything about this.
Unfortunately, I'm not. It's a big ball of wax, a can of worms to open, and we could spend the whole hour in here once we open it, but it intersects with known history in the most obvious way with MKUltra, you know, the CIA program of the early 50s that went on, well, officially until the 70s, but that's been documented in terms of using children, or rather taking children in order to traumatize them, in order to discover ways to control, mind control, and fragment the psyche and develop psychic abilities and so on and so forth. Like, this is a difficult subject to talk about because there's a lot of speculation there as compared to the documentation, and it's quite difficult to separate what's real from what's not real. But what's definitely real is that there was an organized program of sexually traumatizing children for specific ends, to create certain results. And I think that can be traced back prior to CIA and the Nazi nexus that came up in the US in the late 40s to occult secret societies, whether or not, you know, whatever they were, because, you know, one doesn't have to believe in the occult or even believe that those groups believed in the occult to recognize that they were organized and they were doing these things. Like, it's very complex in terms of what the, you know, deciphering the motives of individuals or groups. But it definitely can be traced to the present. And the way that I verified it for myself, because, you know, I became dissatisfied with most of this literature because it was too speculative. So I stepped back and I just started looking at my own past. And it turned out that actually there was an awful lot to uncover there in my own past, growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, pertaining to the Fabian Society in the 20s and 30s and how they were promoting the sexualization of children.
And let me stop you. The Fabian Society was the basic British socialist society, right?
And they created the Labour Party.
Yeah, so go on.
So this was Havelock Ellis is the most well-known, Edward Carpenter, George Bernard Shaw, of course, was a Fabian, but specifically in terms of researching, well, the two main areas of research that I uncovered, one was sexual psychology and how that pertained to children, like how it was desirable to allow children to become sexualized very early on, or to allow that they were, depending on your point of view. The other one was social psychology and crowd control. That was Wilfred Trotter and Byrne, the Tavistock. And so they were doing some heavy, heavy research in terms of how to understand social psychology and apply the knowledge, basically social engineering, how to direct society using these principles. And part of it, or I would say the central part, was sexualizing children very young, and which later became traumatizing them, or it became recognized that actually if you sexualize children prematurely, you would traumatize them. Anyway, so these various schools were created, progressive schools. Turned out I went to one and didn't even realize it. Abbott's Home was the one I went to, which was Fabian-sourced kind of ideology. They seem fairly benign and innocent. It's not as though, I think the most sort of known element that would seem suspect was that encouraged nudity with the children there, but certainly not by the time I was going to them. So it became much more subtle in terms of pushing their agendas. But on the other hand, you've got in the 70s, the Paedophile Information Exchange was this splinter group from the National Council for Civil Liberties, which my family would have been involved in because they were all about the rights of black people and homosexuals and women and so forth, so, and what we think of as progressive movements from that period. Well, paedophiles were also at that time saying, well, you know, we have rights and children have the right also to have sex with us. And so they wanted to abolish the age of consent and make it legal for adults and children to have sex. So that was going on. And it turns out my family was involved in that to some degree. So again, I was really staying quite close to home and things I could verify both personally and historically. And then the third thing, which you may not know about, but most people probably in Britain know about it now, is post-Jimmy Savile, was more and more evidence came out showing that childcare homes, at least from the 70s, were being used as a way to traffic children to these high-level pedophiles.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, in light of what you've laid out, what do you make of the what seems to be a new climate of sexual hysteria among adults in our culture? You know, the idea that, for example, just making a pass at a woman for a man is a form of abuse now.
Yeah, and all these trigger warnings as well, like the smallest thing has to be given a trigger warning. I think it is symptomatic. And I was going to say earlier when we were talking about cultures that there's an interesting sort of variable or counter view about culture is that the more it changes, the more it stays the same, because the culture we create, I think, is always a response to these formative traumatic experiences that we have as children. So essentially, we're just creating more and more complexified defenses against those early traumas.
Would you say this has something to do with not allowing children to develop properly into adulthood?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you arrest the development, but not, I mean, in a really malevolent way or a really traumatic way. So it's even deeper than arresting. I mean, it's fragmentation. So you have a aspect of the psyche that is traumatized that stays actually stuck at an infantile level, and then you have a corresponding other fragment of the psyche that grows up far too fast. So when a child is traumatized sexually, on the one hand, it can't assimilate that experience, so it just blocks it out, and so then you've got the agony and the anguish of the trauma gets isolated off by amnesia often, and that's the infant. And then, but on the other hand, the child has to grow up super fast because it has to cope with the trauma and to some degree identify with the abuser. It sort of side itself with the abuser, and so then you get this accelerated development. On the one hand, it's arrested; on the other hand, it's accelerated. So when you're talking about the phenomena now, where on the one hand people are ignoring the reality of systematized child sex abuse being everywhere and the evidence for it becoming more and more indisputable, on the other hand they're getting hysterical about the smallest kinds of infractions, social infractions, that they see as sexual harassment and so forth. I think you can put those two together in more ways than one.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Another thing it sort of prompts me to wonder is, well, you can see how because of that and because of maybe some kind of a preconscious or subconscious apprehension of that by many people, that we become a victim culture as opposed to a hero culture. I think if we go back to the culture of our grandfathers, you know, 60, 80 years ago, that they lived in a culture that was much more of a hero culture of the archetypal Jungian figure who strives to make things happen and make good things happen.
Right, although unfortunately it seems as though they failed, obviously, to make good things happen. And that, I would say, again, it's traced the effect back to the cause, that hero culture, and I never thought about it in those terms until you said it, but riffing off what you said, itself would have been a compensatory defense against being victimized. So
yeah, and interestingly enough, it rises up. I mean, I'm thinking of the period of, let's say, the 1930s in America. The actual populace of America back in those days was just coming out of the period when behavior was more regimented than ever, you know, in modern history, where more people had to report to the factory at exactly 7 o'clock in the morning and take their lunch break when the whistle blew at noon and go home at 5. And so many people were in that regimented culture and probably, you know, felt victimized by it at some level and maybe compensated for that with, you know, the hero culture, which weirdly, you know, actually got the opportunity to play out in the Second World War. It's odd how history set things up so they were able to enact those, what had been fantasies earlier.
Right. Well, it's what Lloyd Damaris calls psychohistory. So what he's showing is that all historical movements and events can be traced back to childhood experiences. So if you want to understand history, you have to understand the circumstances of the children that grew up to make the history, because they will reenact whatever happens. So, I mean, he talks specifically about Nazi Germany and how the children that grew up to be Nazis, the circumstances of their childhood reflected their behaviors in very specific ways, even the ways that they described Jews related to the kind of awful circumstances that they were raised in, for example, being swaddled, left to sit in their own urine and feces. That was part of the child caring, in quotes, methods that these children who grew up to Nazis were subjected to. So that's just one example, right?
What do you make of the sort of the aggregate manner in which your own generation was raised in the UK and what it has done to them?
I mean, I feel as though I had a fairly exceptional upbringing, and even if I didn't, I would still have to just refer to my own, I think.
Oh.
Can I answer a different question?
Of course.
Maybe we'll come back to that, because I think that was quite difficult for me to think about. But I'll just finish something I wanted to say about the psychohistory, and we'll see if it relates to your question. And that is that, and it was what you were talking about before with the hero culture and all that. Another thing that Damaris writes about is how when there's a period of social liberation, freedom, a lifting of the restrictions in a society, and he talks about the Weimar Republic as his example. So you have a particularly libertarian kind of culture, which of course can easily move over into libertine. And these were the circumstances I grew up in. I grew up in a libertine culture household. Historically, because individually, there's a corresponding reaction against that. There's something in us as individuals and collectively that fears freedom. And if there's too much freedom, because we've been conditioned as children, or rather because we've been punished as children, if we misbehave, then we've been conditioned to fear a kind of reprisal if we act too freely. And so then there's a mechanism that's installed in us that we will actually enact the very same punishments that we fear are going to happen. So then what he's mapped is that you can see in culture, society, and history, you'll have a period of extreme licentiousness or freedom, social freedoms. Shouldn't say licentiousness, it does end up there, but it starts with something seemingly benevolent and progressive, where all of these mores and standards are loosening up and we're questioning them all and we're just basically trying to create this free-for-all. And those periods will be followed by this more draconian clampdown of authoritarianism. And so when you talk about the hero culture, well, and this is also in Freud, you know, it's the id and the superego. You know, the ego is fragmented. It creates these different aspects of its own experience. And it's afraid of everything in the id, which is this unbridled desire of what we would do if we were completely free, like the infant, if it could have total power kind of thing. And then to keep that in check, the superego comes into being, which is idealized version of ourselves as perfectly moral and, you know, that has total control over those unbridled emotions and can contain them. So to me, the hero culture is actually quite observable in Nazi Germany. I mean, that would probably be a good example of it. We think of them now as the opposite of heroic, obviously, because they were psychopaths, but there is this very close overlap between the hero urge and the psychopathic urge, because it's basically the superego that wants to have total moral superiority and total control, and that denies its own baser passions.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing it back, if I can, to my upbringing, I was raised in a libertine household, and the mini culture of my, and it, well, I guess this was British culture, I mean, that's what I'm saying, but it was confusing to me because my family pretended to be something it wasn't, essentially. Like, I grew up in a kind of closet aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I would have to answer, like, what effect there was on my generation growing up in the aristocracy, but the aristocracy I grew up in didn't admit to being an aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was ahead of the curve in terms of it being incredibly free in a social sense or in a moral sense. Like, everything was permissible, at least let's try it, in my family. And so I grew up with that credo, really. Like, I spent much of the first part of my life trying anything I could. Fortunately, I wasn't able to try a lot of it. I tried all the drugs I could, because you can always get drugs. But sexually, I was a bust. I couldn't get sex. You know, nothing worked in that regard. So fortunately, I was protected in some way. But also congruent with that, because there's this part of me that was felt anxiety about such freedom, I was also quite an aesthetic person. Like, I was actually very sort of self-restrained and trying to find boundaries, really, is what it comes down to. Like, I was trying to find the boundaries that I was never given by my family or by my society. In fact, I was given a kind of anti-boundary credo, which is I didn't believe in religion, I didn't believe in politics or politicians, because I'd seen hypocrisy in my own family, really, as far as that was concerned. I just really believed in art and culture. And then I sort of moved over into a spiritual thing, like sorcery and occultism became this fascination for me. And I spent a long time on that path before realizing that was actually a much darker path than I really wanted to be on.
You made an interesting statement in one of your recent blogs that, or at least posed the question as to how is culture perhaps a negation of reality? And I wonder if you could speak to that for a moment.
This is why I was wanting to ask you about the cosmologies, creating cosmologies that justify what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that culture is like that. I think that we're subjected to experiences that we can't process as children. And because we're outside of nature now, we're born into culture, and culture itself is, well, it's a buffer from reality, but in a weird way, it creates worse realities than reality, let's say. Reality is a difficult term, isn't it? It's a buffer from nature, and it creates a more hostile environment than nature itself in a weird way.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah.
And so that's why I think it grows exponentially. So then, insofar as we're born into an environment that is actually more hostile than nature itself, just in different ways, then we develop a defense identity, a defense system, internal defense system that becomes our identity, really, our preferences, our conditioned responses and all of that. But it's also the dissociative mechanism is key to this. We go into fantasy when we can't deal with reality. So our defense system is partly a fantasy one, whereby we have these fantasies and we want those fantasies to be as real as they can be. So insofar as they're not real and we have to move through our environment, we will actually try and implement them. We will try and act them out. So for me, for example, not only did I love Clint Eastwood, but I decided I wanted to be a cop, first of all, and I realized that didn't work, that wasn't going to work. Okay, I'll be a filmmaker. So that was that. How can I make this fantasy realm that I've found as a refuge, how can I actually make it real? well, I'll become one of the people who makes the films that I escape into. It's like going to a higher level. And so in this way, like, culture constantly replicates itself, but also, well, you talked about shape-shifting, but it's also growing.
Like, mm-hmm. It's, how come you never made it to Hollywood?
I did make it to Hollywood when I was 20, and like, in terms of an actual physical quest, I drove from New York to Hollywood in an old Plymouth that I bought. Right as soon as I got to Hollywood, I went to the Holiday Inn, I felt ill, more ill than I'd ever been in my whole life. And I was actually bedridden for about 3 weeks and had the most awful experience probably I've ever had as an adult. Well, it turned out in retrospect, because it took a few years to diagnose it, it was what's called glandular fever. But basically, I was just knocked off my feet and I had these swollen glands in this throat and ear, and it was just a hideous mess. And actually, that condition stayed with me for about 20 or 30 more years as chronic fatigue syndrome. So I don't think it's a coincidence that when I actually, you know, got to the promised land, mm-hmm. the first thing I did, you know, like, my body just completely collapsed. And in retrospect, I can see that, as we were talking about, in the first part of this conversation, the body knows things that the mind doesn't. And I now see, based on not so much experience, but deduction and research, I see Hollywood as a toxic center of a hypertoxic culture, like where a vast amount of the toxins are actually being created.
You must really love the movie La La Land, then.
I haven't seen it because I'm out here in the sticks, so it hasn't got any. Also, I don't even go to the cinema anymore. So,
well, as kind of a final wrap-up question for you, can you give me some idea of what you think a successful culture would be like, and what would the shape and texture and flavor of it would be, and how would it help escort its young members into well-functioning adulthood?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is small,
mm-hmm.
which is the opposite, you know, to the global village. Like, you know, we have this idea that we're moving and evolving towards some great cosmic brain or, you know, collective humanity experience. And I have to say, I'm skeptical about that. I imagine you are too.
Oh, yeah.
With or without the technology or the infrastructure, you know. I think that we already are one humanity, so to speak. I don't really like the word humanity, but anyway, I think we're all interconnected, and that's a fundamental baseline reality, whether you want to say DNA or collective unconscious or whichever, you know, discipline you frame it through or belief system. I think it is an experiential reality. And I think that any community/culture that is enlivening would be one that was aware of our ancestors and was in touch with that reality in some way. And I can't tell you how, because I don't have, like, the experience I have of it is in dreams. And when I'm asleep, I can be aware of that I'm connected to a deeper layer of being that seems to extend beyond this life and this time stream. But it's not a religion, or it's not a belief system. I want it to be experiential, and there's very little to talk about that experientially. Well, my brother and my mother died recently, and I did experience some kind of connection to them after they were dead that seemed verifiable in some way, but that's obviously very subjective. In terms of, yeah, a culture that would be benign would be one, I think, that has that foundation or that core of, it's funny because it's the thing that's almost being atomized now. Well, everything's being atomized now, but the family unit, like the mother, father, that's the foundation that I never had in my family. Like, I'm a child of divorce and they were both alcoholics. So even when they were together, they were drunk and so on and so forth. You don't want to hear the whole story, but you can extrapolate from that. In terms of just that basic foundation of a man and a woman, because this is totally un-PC now, being together in union and giving birth to a child, and that being the core around which a community forms. I guess I'm doing about going, you know, Adam and Eve redux or something. I think that the only way I can imagine a benign community culture arising from where we are now is the complete and total collapse and destruction of the one that we have. And I don't mean destruction by force, really. I just internal. The internal elements would destroy it. The very nature, it's like you're talking about architecture, you know, if it's not built to be renovated, well, it's going to collapse. And I think that's the world we're in, and I think that's fine. I think the challenge is for those of us who are in it to try and create the community culture that we want to be in while all that collapse is, that slow collapse and long emergency is occurring around us.
Well, that's a fair statement, and I think that we can wrap it up with that.
With a dot, and then finished sentence, yeah.
That's all right. I'd like to kind of get to that place. I don't know if I'll live to see that place. I think both of us are in agreement that this culture is headed for some kind of a reckoning. You know, I think both of us have said in our blogs that to some extent we see the wheels coming off in 2017. So let's kick back and see what happens.
And yeah, buckle up and say goodbye to Kansas.
Well, I don't know about Kansas.
Say goodbye to Oz, actually. I think we're trying to get
maybe
back
Arkansas.
To Kansas.
But, Jason, thank you very much for being on my podcast, and I'll alert my listeners to the fact that I will have recorded earlier on your podcast, and we'll have sort of a mutual cross-posting of podcasts, and I'll put yours up with me along with this one on the website. So I will also put up your website information. I'll check in down the road with you, and it'll be an interesting year. So have an interesting year. Turn 50 with cheer.
Thanks.
We will ride again, as I like to say.
Thanks, Jim.